Street, but no Abbey's. Let's sit for a minute, he said. Catch our breath. They all sat against the rotting boards of the house. Ethan said, Maggie, Hector, no military experience, right? Head shakes. I was a Black Hawk pilot. Saw some insane combat in Fallujah. We have 6 blocks to cover across very hostile territory, and there's a right way to move in these situations to minimize exposure. From our current position, we can only see the surrounding block, but when we get across the street, our perspective will change. We'll have new information. Even though we have 6 blocks to contend with, we are going to look at that distance incrementally. Maggie and I will cross the street first and secure a position. I'll evaluate the area from our new vantage point, and when I give the high sign, Kate and Hector will join us. Make sense? Nods. I want to say one last thing about how we're going to move. It's called a tactical column. We'll keep close together as we run, but the place should be controlled enough for you to stay alert. If the coast is clear, the temptation will be to focus on areas in the distance to see what's coming, but that's a mistake. If we see Abbey's coming from 100, 200 yards out, there's time for us to react. Worst thing that can happen is a surprise ambush. One of these things coming out of a bush, around a corner, and then you don't even have time to raise your weapon. So watch your danger areas. That's top priority. If you pass a bush and you can't see what's behind it, you cover that bush. Got it? Maggie's shotgun had begun to tremble in her grasp. Ethan touched her hand. You're going to do fine, he said. She turned away suddenly and threw up in the grass. Kate patted her back and whispered, It's okay, honey. It's okay to be scared. It's right to be scared. It'll make you sharp. Ethan considered how utterly unprepared this woman was. Maggie had never been exposed to anything approaching this level of horror and pressure, and yet she was slugging her way through it. Maggie wiped her mouth and took a few deep breaths. You okay? Ethan asked.
I can't do it. I thought I could, but...
I know you can.
No, I should just go back.
We need you, Maggie. The people in the cavern need you. She nodded. You'll be with me, Ethan said, and we'll take it one step at a time.
Okay.
You can do this.
I just need a moment.
He'd seen this in war. Combat paralysis. When the total horror of the violence and the constant threat of death overwhelmed a soldier. In his time in Iraq, the nightmare scenario was a sniper's bullet or an IED. But even on the worst days in the streets of Fallujah, there wasn't anything that wanted to eat you alive. He gave Maggie a hand up. You ready? He asked.
I think so.
He pointed across the street. We're going to cross to that house on the corner. Don't think about anything else.
Okay.
You're going to see some bodies in the street. Just want to warn you. Ignore them. Don't even look at them.
Danger areas.
She tried to smile. You got it. Now stay close. Ethan picked up his shotgun. Butterflies in his stomach. That old familiar fear. 5 steps out from the side of the house, the bodies in the street were in full view, and you couldn't not look at them. He counted 7 people, 2 of them children, literally ripped apart. Maggie was keeping up. He could hear her footsteps, 1 meter or 2 behind his. They hit the street, nothing but the sound of their footfalls on the pavement. They're panting. Up and down First Avenue, nothing. It was so quiet. They crossed into the yard and accelerated the last few steps to the 2-story Victorian, crouched down under a window. Ethan glanced around the corner, made another scan up and down first. All clear. He looked back at Kate and Hector and raised his right arm. They came to their feet and started jogging, Kate out in front and moving with confidence, like she knew what she was doing. Hector a few uncomfortable paces back. Ethan could tell the moment they saw the bodies. Hector's face fell, and Kate's jaw set, and they couldn't tear their eyes away. Ethan looked at Maggie and said, You did great. Then all four of them were together again. Ethan said, "Street's empty. I don't know why it's so quiet, but let's take advantage. All four of us this time. We'll head out into the street and go right down the middle of it."
"Why?"
Hector asked. "Isn't it safer to stay near the houses, not so out in the open?"
"Corners are not our friends," Ethan said. He gave Hector and Kate a minute to catch their breath. Then he stood.
"What's the next destination?" Kate asked.
"There's a green Victorian two blocks down on the other side of the street, a row of juniper shrubs along the front. We'll get behind those. Everyone ready?"
"Want me last in line?" Kate asked.
"Yes, cover anything on our right and glance back every so often to make sure we aren't getting flanked." It was a deceptively peaceful morning on 8th Street. They jogged down the middle of the road, quaint Victorians on either side, and all those white picket fences bright and perfect in the early sun. Ethan's stomach ached with hunger. He couldn't remember the last time he'd eaten. He switched between studying the houses on their left and the road ahead. The side yards unnerved him more than anything, those narrow canyons between houses that led into backyards he couldn't see. They reached the first intersection. So strange. He'd expected the town to be thick with Abbeys. Wondered if they'd left, raided the town for a night and gone back out into the wild the way they'd come, through Pilcher's Gate. That would simplify things if he could get control of the fence and just shut them back out. The green Victorian was close now, two houses down. He picked up the pace and veered toward the front yard. Suddenly Kate was running beside him.
"What's wrong?" he asked, breathless.
"Faster," she gasped.
"Just run."
Ethan jumped the curb, sprinted through the grass, glanced back, nothing. They reached the junipers, scrambled through the branches, ducked down in the shadow between the bushes and the house, everybody out of breath. Ethan said,
"Kate, what happened?" "I saw one."
"Where?"
"Inside of one of the houses on the street."
"Inside?"
"It was just standing at a window looking out."
"You think it saw us?"
"I don't know."
Ethan rose up slowly on his knees, peeked through the branches.
"Get down," Kate whispered.
"I have to check. Which house was it?"
"Brown one with yellow trim. Swing on the front porch. Two gnomes in the yard."
He saw it. Saw the screen door swinging closed. Heard the distant slap of the wood smacking the frame. But he didn't see the Abbey. Ethan lowered himself back behind the bushes.
"It's outside," he said. "The screen door just closed. I don't know where it is."
"It could be coming around the house," Kate said. "Sneaking up along the side. How smart are these things?"
"Scary."
"Do you know how they hunt? How finely tuned their senses are?"
"No idea."
Maggie said,
"I hear something."
Everyone hushed. It was a clicking, scraping sound. Ethan straightened just enough to peek through the branches again. The Abbey was moving upright on the sidewalk toward the house. The clicking was its talons on the concrete. A large bull, 250 pounds at least. It had fed recently. Ethan could barely see the pulsing of its massive heart through the dried blood and viscera that clung to its chest like a bib. At the foot of the porch, it stopped. Turned its head. Ethan ducked. Held his finger to his lips and pulled Kate's head over so he could whisper in her ear.
"It's at the porch, 20 feet away. We may have to engage."
She nodded. He got onto his knees, raised the shotgun, and poked his head above the juniper.
"Did you rack a shell into the tube?"
"Of course I racked a shell into the tube. I ghost-loaded this gun last night." The Abbey was gone, but the smell of it was potent. Close. It shot up screaming on the other side of the bush, teeth bared, eyes like wet, black stones. The blast was deafening, and despite the size of the thing, the slug punched it back into the grass. It went down on its back with a sucking chest wound, dark blood bubbling out like a geyser across the translucent skin. Kate was already on her feet, Hector and Maggie frozen behind the bush. Ethan said, "We have to move." He clawed his way out.
The Abbey was still alive, moaning and trying to plug the quarter-size hole, watching in disbelief as it bled out. It reached for Ethan as he moved past, a talon catching on the hem of his jeans, tearing easily through the denim. Kate was right behind him, Hector and Maggie slower in coming. "Move!" he yelled. They ran into the street. Sweat beaded on Ethan's forehead, streaming down into his eyes with a saltwater sting. They crossed the next intersection. Nothing was coming. Ethan looked back over his shoulder down 8th. Maggie and Hector were running their hearts out, arms pumping, and nothing behind them as far as he could see. The school took up the entire next block on Ethan's right. Playground equipment standing lonely behind a chain-link fence. Seesaws, swing sets, slides, merry-go-rounds. A tetherball pole, a basketball hoop. The red brick of the school beyond. Maggie said, "Oh my God!" Ethan looked back. She had stopped in the middle of the street and was staring at the school. He ran back to her. "We have to keep going," she pointed. A door in the side of the building had swung open, and a man was standing in the threshold, waving one arm. Maggie said, "What do we do?" "What do we do?" One of those decisions that could decide everything. Ethan scaled the 4-foot fence and raced across the schoolyard, passing a sandbox and monkey bars in the shadow of a giant cottonwood whose yellow leaves had plastered the pavement. The man holding open the door was Spitz, the Wayward Pines postman, an inventive position for a town that had zero need for the mail. Yet still, he'd walked the streets several days a week, stuffing mailboxes with fake junk mail, bullshit tax notices, and the like. He was a brawny, extravagantly bearded man, larger through the waist than one might think for someone who lived on their feet. Presently he stood in a shredded black t-shirt and kilt, his fate costume, with his left arm wrapped in a piece of bloody fabric. He wore a nasty slice across his chest, and a piece of flesh had been gouged out of his right leg. He said, "Hi, Sheriff," as Ethan arrived. "Didn't expect to see you." "Back at you, Spitz. You look like shit." "Just a flesh wound," the man grinned. "We thought the other groups were wiped out. Ours made it through the tunnel, up to the cavern." "How many of you?" 96. "I got 83 down in the basement of the school." Kate asked, "Harold?" Spitz shook his head. "I'm sorry." Hector said, "We thought everyone else had been killed." "We were attacked on the way to the tunnels, lost about 30 down by the river. Brutal. As you can see, I got in a little scuffle with one of those sons of bitches. Took 5 men to drag it off, and if one of them hadn't had a machete, it would have killed us all. I heard the gunshot a minute ago. That's what drew me outside." "One came after us a little ways up the block," Ethan said. "We thought maybe they'd all gone back into the woods." "Oh no, town's still crawling with them. I've been making house raids within sprinting distance. There's people still hiding in their homes. I rescued Gracie and Jessica Turner just before dawn. Jim had nailed them into a closet. He isn't with your group, is he?"
"I saw him last night," Ethan said. "He didn't make it."
"Well, that's too bad."
"How are your people?" Maggie asked.
3 died from their wounds overnight. 2 are in pretty rough shape. Probably won't last the day. A bunch of us are scraped all to hell. Everyone's freaked out. No food, just a little water from the fountains. We had a teacher in our group, and if he hadn't said to come here, we'd all be dead. No question in my mind. It was war last night."
"How secure is the basement?" Ethan asked.
"Could be worse. We're locked in behind 2 doors in a music classroom. No windows. Only 1 way in and out. We've built barricades. I'm not saying it's impenetrable, but we're hanging in."
A scream erupted several blocks away.
"Better get your asses inside," Spitz said. "Sounds like whatever you killed had a buddy."
Ethan looked at Kate, back at Spitz.
"I'm headed for the mountain," he said, "for Pilcher."
Maggie said, "If there are injured people, I may be able to help. I was in school to become a nurse back in my old life."
"We'd love to have you," Spitz said.
A second scream answered the first. Ethan said, Do you guys have any weapons?
One machete.
Shit. He'd have to leave them with someone who could shoot. This group of people needed some form of protection beyond a big knife.
Kate, you stay with them too, he said.
You need me.
Yes, but if we both go and get killed, then what? At least this way, you're the backup plan if I don't make it back. And meanwhile, you can protect these people.
Hector said, like he hadn't quite fully committed to the idea.
Well, Ethan, I guess it's just you and me then.
Will I be seeing you again, Sheriff?
Here's hoping. Ethan grabbed Maggie's hand and said,
Bedside table drawer?
Yeah. Go upstairs. Turn right when you come off the staircase. It's the door at the end of the hall.
Your house locked?
No.
Which one is it?
Pink, with white trim. Wreath on the front door.
Maggie and Spitz headed into the school. Ethan started to turn away, but Kate grabbed him, her hands cold on the back of his neck. She pulled him toward her and kept pulling until their lips touched, and then she kissed him, and he was letting it happen.
She said, "Be careful," and disappeared through the door.
Ethan looked at Hector. The Abbeys were howling.
Two blocks, Ethan said. We can make it.
They ran through the schoolyard, between picnic tables, into an open playing field, heading straight for the fence. Ethan glanced back, saw movement in the street behind them, pale forms on all fours. With the shotgun slung across his shoulder, he put two hands on the fence and leapt over the top, hit the ground running on the other side, streaked into an intersection. Right, clear. Left, four Abbeys en route, still several blocks away. Halfway down the block, an Abbey broke through the glass of a front window and charged Ethan.
"Keep running!" he screamed at Hector,
then stopped, squared up, and racked a fresh shell. Hector blitzed by, and Ethan put the monster down with a headshot. He chased after Hector, and as they reached the last intersection before Maggie's house, it occurred to him that he never asked what her car looked like. There were loads of them on this block, and two parked on the curb in front of Maggie's place. Abbeys appeared straight ahead, coming toward them from Main Street, one block away, and Ethan looked back just in time to see a half dozen round the corner, two blocks back, near the school. He and Hector covered the last 30 feet through Maggie's yard. Up the steps, onto the covered porch. Jerked open the screen door. Abbeys screaming, converging. Hector beginning to lose his grip. Ethan turned the knob, put his shoulder into the door, and rushed inside.
"Lock the door!"
Ethan yelled as Hector stumbled inside. "Stand halfway up the staircase and shoot the shit out of anything that gets in."
"Where are you going?"
"Car keys."
Ethan doubled up the stairs, screams audible through the walls. At the top, he turned right and raced toward the closet door at the end of the hall. Smashed through without slowing, yellow walls, white crown molding, soft curtains drawn. A terry cloth robe draped over the back of a chair. A big, pillowy bed, neatly made. Stack of Jane Austen novels and an incense burner on the bedside table. The cold air still redolent of fragrant smoke. Maggie's haven. Ethan hurried to the bedside table, pulled open the drawer. Downstairs, the sound of glass breaking, wood splintering, snarling. Hector yelled something as Ethan shoved his arm toward the back of the drawer, felt his fingers graze the keys. A shotgun blast followed. Abbeys screamed, Hector shouting,
"Oh, God!"
Shuck, shuck, as he racked another slug.
Boom!
Shuck, shuck. The spent shell falling down the stairs. Ethan jammed Maggie's keys into the front pocket of his jeans and started down the hallway. Hector screamed. No more shots. The smooth soles of Ethan's boots slid across the hardwood floor as he reached the top of the stairs and tried to arrest his forward momentum. Blood. Everywhere. Three Abbeys on Hector, one tearing at his right leg, another ripping the biceps out of his arm. A third chewing its way through the fascia muscles into his stomach. Hector shrieking, pounding his free hand into the skull of the Abbey who was gutting him. Ethan raised the shotgun. The first slug decapitated the Abbey burrowing into Hector's stomach, and he shot the second one as it looked up snarling, but the third had a head start, and it was airborne. Talons out, seconds from crashing into Ethan by the time he got the Mossberg pumped and fired. It tumbled back down the staircase and crashed into two Abbeys that had just torn through the front door. Ethan racked a shell and steadied himself at the top of the staircase, trying to process his next move, fighting panic, the inescapable thought that it was all coming off the rails right now. His left arm was so tender from the Mossberg's recoil, it was agony just pulling the stock snug against his shoulder. The two Abbeys crawled out from under the dead Abbey and started for him, and Ethan shot them both down as they climbed. The house was hazy with gun smoke, and for a moment the only sound was the pneumatic hiss as the femoral artery in Hector's leg jetted arcs of red at the front door. The stairs looked treacherous, soaked in blood. Hector was groaning and shaking as he held his intestines in his hands in some kind of horrified wonder. He was bleeding out mercifully fast, shock white, with a cold sweat matting down his hair, giving his face a corpse-like sheen that foretold what was coming. He stared up at Ethan with a look only a dying soldier can give the one the bullet missed. Fear? Disbelief? Please God tell me this isn't happening. The front door had been torn off its hinges, and through the opening, Ethan watched more Abbeys stream into the yard. They would eat Hector while he took his last breaths. Ethan pulled his pistol, clicked off the safety. No idea if it were true, but he said, "You're going someplace better." Hector just stared. "I should have let you go find the keys." Ethan shot the pianist between the eyes. As the monsters flooded in through the front door, he was already running down the hall away from Maggie's bedroom. He took the second doorway on his right, quietly shut it after him, and flicked a lock that didn't stand a chance of stopping anything. There was a clawfoot tub under a window of frosted glass. As he moved toward it, he could hear the Abbeys through the door, eating. Ethan set the shotgun on the pedestal sink, stepped into the bathtub. He flipped the hasp on the window, raised it 2 feet off the sill. Tight squeeze. He climbed up onto the lip of the bathtub and looked out the window into a small backyard, fenced and empty. The staircase creaked, the Abbeys coming. Out in the hall, there was a great collision, like something had crashed at full speed into one of the doors. Ethan stepped back down into the bathroom and grabbed the shotgun. An Abbey screamed on the other side of the door. Something slammed into the bathroom door. The wood started to split down the middle. Ethan racked a shell and shot a slug through the center of the door, heard something thunk into the wall on the other side. There was now a slug-sized hole in the door, and a puddle of blood leaking underneath it, beginning to spread across the checkered tile. Ethan climbed up onto the rim of the bathtub. He dropped the shotgun on the roof and squeezed through the window as another Abbey smashed into the door behind him. Kneeling under the window frame, Ethan fed 8 shells into the tube and then draped the strap over his shoulder. The Abbey was still trying to beat down the bathroom door. Ethan closed the window and sidestepped carefully down to the edge of the roof. It dropped 12 feet to the backyard. He got down on his hands and knees and lowered himself over the edge, clutching the gutter until he managed to extend himself fully and reduce the drop to 5 feet. He hit the ground hard and let his legs buckle to absorb the impact, rolled, and quickly regained his feet. Through the panes of glass in the back door, he could see things running inside the house. Ethan jogged around the brick patio, his muscles, his bones, every square inch of real estate on his body caught in a trajectory of increasing agony. The fence was built of weathered 1x6s, 5 feet high, with a gate that led out into the side yard. He peered over the top, no Abbeys that he could see, threw the latch and tugged the gate open just enough to slide through. Up on the second floor, he heard glass explode. He jogged alongside the house and slowed as he reached the front yard. For the moment, empty. He stared at the 2 cars parked along the curb in front of Maggie's house. An old CJ5 Jeep with a soft top. A white Buick station wagon that looked prehistoric. He dug the keys out of his pocket. 3 on the ring. All blank. Somewhere above him, he heard a scrape that might have been talons dragging across the tin roof. He sprinted out into the yard. Halfway to the curb, he looked back just in time to see an Abby leap down off the roof over the porch. It hit the ground and charged. Ethan stopped at the sidewalk, spun, raised the shotgun, and fired a slug through its sternum. Inside the house, screams rose up. The station wagon was the closest, 50-50 chance of being Maggie's car. Ethan pulled open the passenger side door, dove in, and shut it behind him. Climbing in behind the steering wheel, he jammed the first key into the ignition. Nothing. Come on! Key number two. It slid in nicely, but it wouldn't turn. An Abby exploded out the front door of Maggie's house. Number three. Four Abbeys appeared behind the first, as two of them rushed out onto the grass to their dying friend. The last of the three keys failed to even enter the keyhole. Fuck, 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 fuck. Ethan glanced down in the seat and crammed himself against the floorboard. He couldn't see a thing, but he could hear the Abbeys in the yard. They're going to look in and see you, and then what? Go right now. Reaching up, he grasped the door handle and quietly tugged. The door creaked open. He slithered out onto the pavement, staying low against the car, hidden from view of the house. No Abbeys in the street. He rose up until he could just see through the windows. Counted six of them in the front yard, and through the open door he could see two more eating what was left of Hector. The Jeep was parked a few feet up from the station wagon's bumper. He grabbed the shotgun out of the front seat and crawled across the pavement. Visible for several seconds, he passed between the Buick and the Jeep, but they didn't see him. Ethan stood, stared through the plastic windows of the soft top. Some of the Abbeys had gone back inside. One was still crouched over the carcass of the Abbey Ethan had just shot, whimpering. The driver's side door was unlocked. Ethan climbed in, set the shotgun between the seats. He got the first key in as an Abbey screamed. They'd seen him. They were moving his way. He turned the key. Nope. He started fumbling for the second key and then realized there wasn't time. He grabbed the shotgun and jumped down out of the Jeep, ran into the middle of the road. Five were already running at him. No misses or you die. He shot the one out in front, and then the two to the left, backpedaling in the street as the last pair closed in. It took three rounds to bring down the fourth. Only one to drop the fifth as it drew within 10 feet. Three more Abbeys ran out of the house. On the periphery of his vision, he noted movement in the streets all around him, swarms of Abbeys coming from every direction. A growl behind him turned his head. Two Abbeys darting straight at him on all fours like a pair of missiles, a large female and a smaller Abbey that couldn't have weighed more than 75 pounds. He aimed at the smaller one. Bullseye. It went rolling across the pavement. Its creamy-eyed mother skidded to a stop and crouched over her fallen young, let out a long, tragic howl. Ethan ejected the spent shell, aimed. The mother looked at him, and there was no mistaking the intelligent, burning hate that narrowed her eyes. She came up on her hind legs, ran at him, screeching. Click. Empty. He dropped the shotgun and drew his pistol as he backed toward the Jeep, brought the mother down with 250-caliber rounds through her throat. They were everywhere. He made his move toward the Jeep. A 7-foot-tall Abbey leapt onto the hood. Ethan accidentally put another two rounds, double-tap muscle memory, through his upper torso. He reached the driver's side door as an Abbey appeared around the back of the Jeep. Ethan dropped it with a headshot at point-blank range, a half a second before the Abbey got a talon through his windpipe. He climbed in. Couldn't remember which key he'd tried last time, and just shoved in the first one he could get between his fingers. An Abbey appeared behind the plastic window on the passenger side. A talon sliced through, and a long, muscled arm reached inside. Ethan lifted the Desert Eagle from his lap and shot it in the face as it tried to climb into the Jeep. The key wouldn't turn. As he fumbled with the next one, a terrifying thought crossed his mind. What if Maggie's car was actually parked across the street? Or up the curb a little ways. It's not like she ever had to drive it. Then I will be eaten alive in this Jeep. A slashing behind Ethan. He glanced back as a black talon tore through the plastic rear window. The view through the old, dirty plastic was blurry, but he could see enough of the monster to draw a bead. He shot through the window. Blood spattered across the plastic, and the pistol's slide locked back. Empty. With only one magazine, it would take him a minimum of 30 seconds to dig out the box of 50-caliber rounds, reload it, wait. No. He hadn't brought extra ammo for the Desert Eagle. Only the Mossberg. The Abbeys were closing in. He could see a dozen of them through the windshield and hear more heading toward him from Maggie's house. He grasped the second key, thinking, how strange that whether I live or die comes down to whether or not this key will turn. It went into the ignition. He jammed his foot down hard into the clutch. Please. The engine turned over several times and sputtered to life. The gurgling noise of it was life. Ethan popped the emergency brake and wobbled the gear shift, which operated a 3-speed manual transmission. He shifted into reverse, then gunned the gas. The Jeep lurched back and crashed into the station wagon, pinning a screaming Abby to the bumper. Ethan shifted into first, cranked the wheel, floored the pedal. Out into the street. Abbeys everywhere. If he'd been driving something substantial, he wouldn't have hesitated to plow right through them, but the Jeep was compact, with a narrow wheelbase that made it prone to rolling over. He doubted it could sustain a head-on collision with even a modest-sized bull. It felt so good to accelerate. He took a sudden left turn to miss an Abbey, the Jeep leaning over on two wheels. Brought it back down, four coming straight at him, undaunted, no signs of deviating from their kamikaze course. He turned hard, drove over the curb, plowed through a picket fence at 30 miles per hour, through the front yard of a corner lot, and punched through the fence again on the other side, the Jeep taking a thunderous jarring as it came back off the curve and hit the road, tires squealing as he straightened out the steering wheel. The road ahead was clear. RPM maxed. Ethan shifted into second. Whatever was under the hood of this thing had some meat on its bones. Ethan glanced in the side mirror. A swarm of Abbeys, 30 or 40 strong, was chasing him down the middle of the street, their screeches audible, even over the roar of the 8-cylinder engine. He hit 60, blasting through the next block. Past a toddler park where a dozen baby Abbeys were feeding on a pile of bodies in the grass. Must have been 40 or 50 bodies. One of the doomed groups. 6th Avenue was coming to an abrupt end. The forest of towering pines looming in the distance, Ethan dropped a gear. He'd outrun the Abbeys by a quarter mile at least. At 13th Street, he took a hard right turn and punched the pedal again. He drove alongside the woods for a block and then past the hospital. Ethan dropped one more gear, took a slow left turn onto the main drag out of town. Floored it. Wayward pines dwindled away in the rearview mirror. He drove past the goodbye sign, wondering if anyone had made it this far into the woods when the mayhem had ensued. As if in answer to his question, he passed an Oldsmobile parked on the side of the road. Nearly every shard of glass had been busted out, the exterior covered in dents and scratches. Someone had tried to flee to the outskirts of town, only to have a group of Abbeys find them. At the sharp curve ahead sign, he veered off the road into the forest, kept his speed up in the trees. The boulders appeared in the distance. He had a pocket full of shotgun shells and no shotgun, a devastating pistol with no rounds left. Not exactly the ideal setup for what he was about to do. The large outcropping that masked the entrance to the superstructure loomed 100 yards ahead. Ethan shifted into second, tightened his grip on the steering wheel. 50 yards. He had the pedal down against the floorboard, the heat of the overworked engine coming through the vents. At 25 yards, he braced himself. The speedometer holding steady. He was driving at 40 miles per hour into a wall of rock. Teresa Burke. She was in Seattle, their old home in Queen Anne. Her family in the backyard on one of those perfect summer evenings when you could see everything. Rainier, the Puget Sound and the Olympics across the water. Lake Union and the skyline. Everything cool and green, and the water shimmering as the sun fell. All that suffering through the chill gray days of endless drizzle was rewarded with nights like this. The city almost too beautiful to take. Ethan stood by the grill, cooking salmon fillets on planks of wine-soaked cedar. Ben strummed an acoustic guitar in a hammock. She was there. Everything so bright, the dream verging toward lucidity. She even questioned the reality as she moved to her husband and placed her hand on his shoulders. But she could smell the fish cooking, could actually feel the sunlight in her eyes, and the good bourbon she was drinking was a pleasant lethargy in her legs. She said, "I think those look ready." And then the world began to shake, and even though her eyes were already open, she somehow opened them again to find Ben shaking her awake. She sat up from the cold rock floor of the cavern, her bearings lost. For a moment she had no idea where she was. People were running past her toward a heavy log door that now stood wide open. The dream was fading fast, the real world rushing back in like a pounding hangover. She couldn't remember the last time she'd dreamed of her life before, and the timing now seemed especially cruel. She looked at Ben and said,
"Why is the door open? We have to leave, Mom. Why? The Abbeys are coming back. One of the watchers saw a swarm of them scaling the cliffs."
That jerked her back into full consciousness.
"How many?" she said. "I don't know." "Everyone's leaving the cavern? They don't think the doors can handle another attack. Come on."
He took hold of her hands and pulled her up onto her feet. They moved toward the open door, panic intensifying in the cavern, people bunching closer as they neared the exit, elbows jabbing into ribs, skin brushing hard against skin. Teresa reached down and grabbed Ben's hand, pulling him in front of her. They pushed their way through the threshold of the massive door. The tunnel echoed with voices, everyone fighting to reach the daylight at the opening. Teresa and Ben emerged under a midday sky so blue it looked fake. She stepped right to the edge of the cliff and took a stomach-swimming glance straight down. Said,
"Oh, Jesus!"
At least 20 Abbeys had begun to scale the cliff. Another 50 were gathering at the base, 300 feet below. More still coming out of the forest. Ben moved toward the edge, but she held him back.
"Don't even think about it."
What had started as chaos inside the cavern was escalating toward hysteria out in the open. People had seen what was coming. Some had fled back into the tunnel. Others were trying to climb higher up the mountain. A few had become frozen with fear, sitting down against the rock, trying to tune the world right out. Those whom Ethan had armed were getting into positions along the uppermost ledge, trying to take aim on the Abbeys that were already climbing the wall. Teresa watched one woman drop her rifle, saw a man lose his footing and fall screaming into the forest. The first gunshot rang out from the ledge.
"Mom, what do we do?"
Teresa hated the terror she saw building in Ben's eyes. She glanced back at the rocky path leading into the cavern.
"Should we have stayed inside?" Ben asked. "And prayed the door held?" "No."
To the right of the cave opening, a narrow ledge extended around the mountain. From this distance, Teresa couldn't tell if it was navigable, but it was something.
"Grab on."
She grabbed Ben's arm and hustled him back up the path toward the tunnel as more gunshots broke out behind them.
"I thought you said, we aren't going back into the cavern, Ben."
When they reached the opening to the tunnel, Teresa got her first good look at the ledge. It couldn't have been wider than a foot. There were no planks, no cables. It looked right on the edge of plausible. She faced her son as people streaked past them, heading back into the tunnel. Somewhere in the forest below, an Abbey shrieked.
"We have to follow this ledge," she said.
Ben stared at the slim, natural path across the cliff face and said,
"That looks scary. Would you rather be trapped in that cavern when 50 Abbeys break the door down? What about everyone else? My job is to protect you. You ready?"
He gave a quick, unconvincing nod. Teresa felt her stomach clench. She stepped out onto the ledge and pressed her chest against the wall, her palms trailing across the rock. Taking small, shuffling steps, she clutched handholds where she could find them. After 5 feet, she looked back at Ben.
"See how I did that?"
"Yeah."
"Your turn."
Hard as it had been leaving the safety of that wide path into the mountain, it was infinitely more excruciating to watch her son step out onto the ledge. The very first thing he did was look down.
"No, don't do that, honey. Look at me."
Ben looked up.
"It's a lot scarier in the daylight. Just focus on taking safe steps and keep your hands on the wall like I am. Sometimes there will be places to grab."
Ben started toward her, step by step.
"You're doing great, honey."
He reached her. They went on. After 20 feet, the exposure opened up wide beneath them, a 400-foot drop straight down to the forest floor. So vertical, if you fell, you wouldn't bounce off anything until you hit the ground.
"How we doing, buddy?"
Teresa asked.
"Okay.
Are you looking down?"
"No."
Teresa glanced back. He was.
"God damn it, Ben. I can't help it," he said. "It makes my stomach feel weird and tingly."
She wanted to reach out, take his hand, hold him tight.
"We need to keep moving," she said.
Teresa couldn't be certain, but the path seemed to be narrowing. Her left foot, which she kept perpendicular to the ledge and pointed into the mountain, was hanging off the ledge by an inch or two. As they arrived at a bend in the mountain, a flurry of gunfire exploded back toward the cavern. Teresa and Ben both looked. Several dozen people were retreating up the path into the tunnel, with a speed and intensity that suggested they were fleeing for their lives. The scream of an Abby, and another broke out as those pale, translucent monsters climbed off the side of the cliff wall. When they got their talons on level ground, the Abbeys rushed on all fours up the path toward the tunnel.
"What if they see us?" Ben asked.
"Don't move," Teresa whispered. "Not even a muscle."
When the last of the Abbeys, she counted 44, had disappeared into the tunnel, Teresa said,
"Let's go."
As they moved around the bend, a deep thumping sound spilled out of the tunnel.
"What is that?"
Ben asked.
"The Abbeys. They're beating on the door to the cavern."
Teresa hugged the cliff and stepped around the corner onto a 6-inch ledge, her heart in her throat. Suddenly, a great chorus of screams rose up inside the tunnel. 6. Hassler. Gasworks Park, Seattle, Washington, 1,816 years ago. Hassler flips burgers on a grill in the shadow of the remnants of the Seattle Gaslight Company, a collection of rusted cylinders and ironwork that loom in the distance like the ruins of a steampunk skyline. The expanse of emerald grass runs down to the edge of Lake Union, which sparkles under the late afternoon sun. It's June. It's warm. The entire city seems to be out and taking advantage of this rare, perfect day. Sailboat masts add triangles of color to the lake. Kites sprinkle color in the sky. Frisbees slice through the air, and the bright noise of children's laughter echoes from the plant's exhauster compression building, which has been renovated into a play barn. It's the annual company picnic for the Secret Service's Seattle field office, and Hassler can't shake how odd it is to see his team sporting all those bare legs and sandaled feet in place of crisp black suits and pantsuits. His assistant, Mike, walks up carrying two empty plates and a couple of bratwurst requests. As Hassler spears one of the brats, he spots Teresa Burke, moving away from the group she's been standing with, heading down toward the shoreline at a pace substantially faster than a leisurely stroll. Hassler sets down the fork and looks at his assistant.
"Did I mention I'm promoting you?" Hassler says.
Mike's eyes go wide with self-interest. The young man has only been working with Hassler for 8 months, but he has, on a number of occasions, demonstrated a complete lack of awareness regarding the fact that his main purpose in life is answering the phones, pouring coffee, and typing up the special agent in charge's dictation. Mike says,
"Seriously?"
Hassler lifts the white and red checkerboard apron over his head and appoints his apprentice.
"Your new duties include asking people if they like a hamburger, bratwurst, or both,
and also not burning shit. Mike's shoulders sag.
I was getting a plate for Lacey.
That your new girl?
Yeah.
Tell her to come over so you can fill her in on the big news.
Hassler slaps Mike on the shoulder and abandons the grill, moving down through the buttercup-dotted grass. Teresa stands by the water. Hassler walks to the shore and stops 20 feet away, pretending to take in the splendor of the view. The radio tower is at the top of Capitol Hill. The house-covered hills of Queen Anne. After a moment, he glances over. Teresa stares hard across the water, her jaw tight, eyes intense. He asks, "Everything okay?" She startles, looks over, wipes her eyes, and musters up a pathetic smile.
"Oh, yeah. Just enjoying the day. Wish we got more like this."
"No kidding. Kind of makes me wish I knew how to sail."
Teresa glances back toward the park, where the rest of the party is mingling. Hassler looks, too. The breeze carries the pleasant reek of beer in plastic cups. He spots Ethan Burke and Kate Hewson standing off to the side, just the two of them, Kate laughing as Ethan gestures his way through what appears to be a story or a joke. Hassler closes the distance between himself and Teresa.
"You're not having much fun, are you?"
She shakes her head.
Hassler says, "These work parties must be weird for the families. My agents see each other day in, day out. Probably spend more time together than with their own spouses. Then you come here, feel like an outsider."
Teresa smiles. "You pretty much nailed it." She starts to say something else, but stops short.
"What?"
Hassler prods, venturing a step closer. He can smell her conditioner, whatever body wash she used that morning. Teresa's eyes are clear and green. The electricity goes in through his eyes and travels down into the pit of his stomach. He feels all at once sick, exhilarated, terrified, alive. Radiantly so.
"Should I be worried?" she asks.
"Worried?"
She lowers her voice.
"About them.
Ethan and..." It's like she doesn't even want to say the word, like it brings a bad taste to her mouth.
"Kate?"
"Worried how?"
He knows. He just wants to hear her say it.
"They've been partners, what, 4 months now?"
she asks.
"Yeah, something like that."
"That's an intense relationship, right? Partner-partner?"
"Can be. You work cases together, often long hours. You have to trust each other with your lives."
"So she's like his work wife."
Hassler says, "I'd be hard-pressed to name any pair of agents under my supervision who aren't close. The nature of the job pushes people together."
"It's just hard," Teresa says.
"I can't imagine."
"So you don't think..."
"I haven't personally seen anything that would make me suspect Ethan is anything other than a devoted husband to you. He's a lucky man. I hope you know that."
Teresa blows out a sigh, puts her face into her hands.
"What's wrong?" he asks.
"I shouldn't have..."
"No, it's fine. Please."
"Do me a favor?"
Teresa asks.
"Name it."
"Don't tell Ethan about this conversation. You don't know me that well, Adam, and I'm not a jealous person. It's just... I don't know what's wrong with me."
"Lips are sealed," Hassler smiles. "And you should know. I'm pretty good with the whole confidentiality thing. The word secret is in my job title, for Christ's sake."
Now Teresa smiles at him, and he can barely stand it. Knows he will think of little else in the days to come.
"Thank you,"
she says, and puts her hand briefly on his arm. He could live a year in this moment.
"I could stay here," he offers. "Keep you company."
"Oh, no, you've got a party to get back to, and I've got some big girl panties to pull up. But you're sweet to offer."
Teresa starts back up the grassy slope, and Hassler watches her go. What it is about this woman that rips his heart out, he can't exactly say. Truth be told, they're just acquaintances. Have talked only a handful of times. When she breezed through the office to bring Ethan something, a bump into each other at the symphony, a cookout he was invited to at the Burke House. Hassler has never been married, hasn't been in love since high school, but in this moment, as he stands on the shore of Lake Union watching Teresa arrive at Ethan's side and wrap her arm around his waist, he feels a flicker of blinding jealousy, as if he's watching the woman who belongs with him falling for another man. Ethan. He crashed the CJ-5 through the rock facade door. A piece of metal struck the windshield, sent a long, branching crack straight down the middle of the glass. Ethan had half expected a brigade of Pilcher's men to be waiting for him, but the tunnel stood empty. He shifted into third gear. 35 miles per hour up the steep grade was the best he could do. Light streamed past overhead, the bedrock dripping on the fractured windshield. Every time he rounded a curve, he expected to see a roadblock, a line of Pilcher's men with assault rifles and orders to shoot on sight. Then again, it was possible Pilcher's people had no idea what he'd done. The only camera feeds in the superstructure were in Surveillance HQ and Pilcher's office. Surveillance techs could be sealed off, locked up, bribed, killed. Pilcher's inner circle, no doubt, held a delusional sense of loyalty toward the man, but Ethan couldn't let himself imagine all of them just standing by while he murdered the last of humanity. His ears popped. He was getting close, and still no sign of resistance. If he had to bet, Pilcher was planning to make certain that every last resident of Wayward Pines had been wiped out, and then tell his people there had been a terrible accident. A fence failure. Nothing to be done. Ethan eased his foot off the gas as the entrance to the superstructure came into view around a long, gentle curve. He rolled into the massive cavern and brought the Jeep to a stop, jammed the gear shift into first, killed the engine. He picked the Desert Eagle up off the floorboard, tugged the slide back, and let it reset so the gun looked loaded. Digging through his pockets again, he only found 2 boxes of 12-gauge slugs and his harpy. Opening the door, he stepped down onto the stone. The arc was quiet, no sound but a soft hiss, the rush of forced air, coming from the blue-lit suspension center. Ethan unzipped his parka and tossed it into the Jeep, shoved the impotent Desert Eagle down the front of his mud-smeared, blood-stained Wranglers. Approaching the thick glass doors that led into level 1 of the complex, it dawned on him that he didn't have a key card. A camera pointed down at him from above the doors. "Are you watching me now?" "You must know I'm here." A voice behind him said, "Put your hands on your head. Interlock your fingers." Ethan raised his hands and turned slowly. A kid in his early 20s with a bandage around his head stood 50 feet away beside the closest of the massive cylindrical reservoirs in the arc, pointing an AR-15 at Ethan. "Hi, Marcus," Ethan said. Marcus moved toward him, and in the jaundiced illumination of the hanging globe lights, looked mad as hell. To be fair, he had cause. During their last encounter, Ethan had pistol-whipped him. "Mr. Pilcher knew you'd come," Marcus said. "He told you that, huh?" "He told me everything you did."
"Everything I did?"
"And he also told me to shoot you, so..."
"People are dying in Wayward Pines, Marcus. Women. Children." Marcus had halved the distance between them, and Ethan could read enough rage in his eyes to suggest he might actually pull the trigger. The glass doors opened. Ethan glanced back, saw a big blonde man enter, aiming a pistol at his heart. Ethan remembered him from that day in the morgue. Alyssa's friend, Alan, Pilcher's head of security. Ethan looked at Marcus, the kid now shouldering the machine gun, preparing to shoot. Ethan said to Alan, "You have orders to shoot me on sight as well?"
"Better believe."
"Where's Ted?"
"No idea."
You might want to hear me out first, Ethan said. Marcus was closing in. As Alan pointed his pistol in Ethan's face, Marcus reached forward and tugged the Desert Eagle out of Ethan's waistband, threw it across the stone.
You have no idea what's going on out there, Ethan said. Either of you.
Last night, Pilcher turned off the fence and opened the gate. He led a swarm of abbeys into the valley. Most of the town has been massacred.
Bullshit, Alan said.
He's lying, Marcus said. Why are we even listening?
Ethan said. I want to show you something. I'm reaching slowly into my pocket.
Alan said, I swear to God that'll be the last move you ever make.
You just took my weapon. Marcus said, Alan, we have orders.
Shut the fuck up, Ethan said. Adults are talking.
He looked back at Alan.
Remember when we met in the morgue? Remember what you asked me to do? Find who killed Alyssa.
That's right.
Alan fixed his eyes on Ethan. I found who killed her, Ethan said. Alan's jaw tensed. It was your boss and Pam.
Alan said, You come in here with an accusation like that, you better be able to prove it.
Ethan pointed at his pocket. May I?
Slowly.
Ethan reached in, fingers probing until he felt it. Lifting out the memory shard, he held up the square shaving of metal and... Pilcher and Pam killed Alyssa. But first they tortured her. The head of surveillance gave this to me. It shows everything.
Alan kept the gun trained on Ethan, unreadable.
I have a question for you, Alan, Ethan said. If what I'm telling you is true, where does your loyalty fall?
He's playing you, Marcus growled.
One way to find out, Ethan said. What does it cost you to look at this, Alan? Unless avenging Alyssa isn't something that interests you.
Behind the glass doors, Ethan saw another armed man sprinting down the corridor. He was dressed in black, armed with a taser, pistol, machine gun, and testosterone. As he approached the glass door, he spotted Ethan and raised his weapon. Alan suddenly wrapped his right arm around Ethan's neck and held the pistol to Ethan's temple. The doors whisked open. Alan said, I've got him.
Stand down.
Kill him, Marcus screamed. You have orders.
The new arrival said,
Alan, what the hell are you doing?
You do not want to shoot this man, Mustin. Not yet.
What I want and don't want doesn't have a whole hell of a lot to do with it. You know that better than any of us.
Alan tightened his grip on Ethan.
Sheriff says the town's been overrun with aberrations and that the boss man opened up the gate. He also says that Mr. Pilcher and Pam are responsible for Alyssa's death.
One thing to say it, Mustin said. Another to prove it.
Ethan held up the memory shard.
He claims it has footage of Alyssa's death.
So what? Marcus said.
Alan leveled a wilting glare at the young man.
What are you saying, son? That on the wild assumption of any of this is true, you'd be okay with Mr. Pilcher killing one of our own, his own daughter, and trying to hide it? You just go along with that?
He's the boss, Marcus said. If he did something like that, I bet he had...
He's not God, is he?
A scream raced up the tunnel and went reverberating through the arc. Alan released Ethan and said,
What was that?
Sounds like some of the abbeys found their way into the mountain. Ethan said, I drove through the entrance to the tunnel. Alan looked at Mustin's weapon.
What do we have that's meaner than an AR-15?
An M230 chain gun on a rolling mount.
Mustin, Marcus, get on that chain gun. Call everybody up, the entire team.
What are you going to do with him?
Marcus said, jutting his chin toward Ethan.
He and I are headed up to surveillance to take a look at what he's got.
We were told to kill him,
Marcus said, raising his gun. Alan stepped toward Marcus, the barrel of the AR-15 digging into his sternum.
Would you mind not pointing your weapon at me, son?
Marcus lowered his gun.
While you and Mustin make sure we don't all get eaten, I'm going to look at what the sheriff says is proof concerning what happened to my friend.